what every veteran gets from Warrior Connection and the Progressive Radio Network. We're an incredible network getting information, education, and knowledge out to everybody. Well, we got another author on today. We're going to have an incredible conversation. I met our guest a few years ago, and we got a little bit work together, and then I got a copy of his book, and I read it, and between Ray and him, they're simply incredible. Well, today on our radio program, we're going to have John Ketwig, and this is going to read this from the cover of his book. I didn't set out to write a book. It was 1982, 14 years after I had last set foot in Vietnam, and 13 years after I had returned to the world. The nightmares were more frequent. I needed to get Vietnam out into the open, but I couldn't talk about it, not after all of those years. Goes on, John Ketwig's powerful memoir of a war in Vietnam. It's a visceral account of a young man's odyssey from the country roads of upstate New York to the jungles of Vietnam. It's a contrast of cultural upheavals and harsh realities of war, from rock and roll philosophy and Beatlemania to the sight of a child burned up by a napalm bomb and a hard rain fell. The author, the title of his book is an unforgettable story of a veteran's rage against his country with a message as relevant today as it was 20 years ago. John, welcome to Warrior Connection.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Doug.
I mean, you know, between you and Ray, I mean, Ray wrote the book on PTSD in Vietnam. You guys have had incredible, horrible experiences. And yet the thing, the message we're putting out on Warrior Connection is you can survive and you can thrive. You can go on to have a successful life, can't you, John?
Yeah. You know, you go out, you get up every morning and go out the door, and you got to feed the family, do what you have to do, and then you come home at night and you give yourself the luxury of thinking or remembering, and sometimes it gets difficult, but for me, I know a lot of people have a lot of problems. For me, it was all about feed the family and do the job that you were hired to do. And I had to shrug off the other stuff and just keep going, you know.
That's all important. I mean, when you wrote your book, I mean, you had the experience. It was very unique. I mean, you were both stationed in Vietnam proper, and the horrors of that thing, and then you also got to Thailand for a brief period of time.
Well, I spent a year in Vietnam and another year in Thailand.
Well, as we say, Sawadee Khun Sabadi Lu.
Yeah, Sabadi Kap. I beat the draft by enlisting, in quotes, to get my choice. My choice was to have nothing to do with it and stay home with my long hair and play in a rock and roll band, but that wasn't a choice that was available to me. And when you enlisted, you volunteered, I guess is the word, for another year. When I ended my tour in Vietnam, I still had 15 months to do in the military, and I did not feel at all comfortable about coming home and walking down the street. There was a fella in the year, the high school class before mine, who'd been one of the very first people, you know, American fighting men in Vietnam, and came home without an arm. And I could not imagine. I was very fortunate in Vietnam that I was never wounded in any way physically. And I couldn't imagine walking down the street and running into this fella and, you know, stick out your hand. Hey, my friend, you know, whoa, sorry. What the heck do you say? What do you do? By the time I came home from Vietnam, by the time my time was up, we'd been seeing pictures of American soldiers standing on the steps of the Pentagon holding a rifle with a bayonet against the protesters. I was on the protesters' side. I didn't want to take the chance that I'd be assigned something like that. So Thailand was a place where you could go on R&R, known for, you know, great entertainment and happy, fun people to be around and everything. And I took a year in Thailand. It was the best thing I ever did. I liken it to a deep sea diver, you know, a scuba diver has to rise slowly or they get the bends. This gave me a chance to rise slowly and get my head together before I came back home. And then, of course, the beauty of it was when I came home, I got out of the military and had the rest of my life ahead of me.
Yeah, I know. At that time, I spent 18 months in Thailand flying on B-52s and maintaining them, and that was an incredible experience because, in contrast, Ray, you were out there in the jungle living in a what you guys called a fighting hole. I want to use the right terminology. The Marines called it a fighting hole, and the Army called it a foxhole. But I went back to a concrete barracks with an honest-to-God iron bed and blankets on the bed.
Yeah, I can relate to everything John is talking about. I mean, he's got a good description of it. Mine was a bit different because I came abruptly home, and before I came home, my platoon was wiped out of, you know, like 80-some percent of us, I guess, or about 80%. And then when I came home, I didn't have any friends or anything, so I was thrown from Vietnam, about like you, Doug, went from Vietnam to the streets of America, and it was hard to adapt. I didn't fit anymore. There's something about me changed, or a lot of things changed, maybe. So I'm sure John is, what he was talking about was that gradual drift back in society. I'm sure that's a great thing if you can get that.
Well, it was nice to have the time, but at the same time, Ray, today, 50 years later, I still feel like I'm carrying around baggage that most people have no idea of. I've never fit back in 100%. You know, the memories stay with you and pop up at the worst possible times, it seems.
Right. I mean, those memories are important memories, and we can't let them go, but it's a matter of how do we learn to live with the memories. I mean, Thanksgiving is coming up next week for me, and Thanksgiving is a horrible, horrible thing. I mean, talk about triggering everything. I went back to Vietnam for the second time at Thanksgiving Day in 1969, a couple hours after I found out my grandma had died, and about 8 hours after I talked to her last. And then we went back to Desert Storm on Thanksgiving Day in 1990, and then I got off active duty for the last time on Thanksgiving Day in 1995. So turkey and me don't work real well.
Well, I can relate to that too, Doug. I mean, there were some things that you got used to, canned ham once in a while. We ate sea rations all the time, what we ate. And sometimes you get a can of ham or something like that. But, you know, you grow a taste for some things, and then you rebel against other things. And by the time I came home, I was just a different person. I mean, I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. My friends weren't with me anymore. I'd lost that security feeling. I had kind of isolated my own self, and so that's when I kind of continued in the isolation along with substance problems. So I guess that we were all adapting in different ways, but none of them were something you would wish on anybody.
John, you talk about, I mean, and you related that, and we've talked about this before, I mean, and all of us have, I mean, the drug and alcohol problems from the veterans, whether they be the veterans of antiquity or go to the newest veterans, it seems to me choosing to wipe out the horror of the memories that you have or anything else, the easiest way to do is drown it in alcohol or misuse drugs. I mean, why do people do that, or why do they need to do that? I'm still struggling to understand why they need to do it, but I understand that it happens.
Well, I think it's just to numb yourself. You've got these thoughts and memories reverberating in your head. You want to go to sleep. You want to escape from it. And, you know, a few drinks or a couple hits off a high-performance cigarette will tend to relax you and help you escape some of it. And at the same time, you know, if you get a buzz from it, if it's something that makes you feel good when you've been feeling bad, wow, the next time you feel bad, you go right back to that. Gee, I know the answer. I know how to fix this. The reality is very, very difficult to live with. It's just poison. And so you do anything you can to try to alleviate it and find a better, more comfortable place in the world.
As I mentioned,
yeah, I want to give you one other perspective too, John, for my own self. As far as the memories were, I was covering everything up. Nobody really wanted to know anyway, but I didn't want to tell them actually. But we had such a bond with these young Marines in combat and all, is that they were like, I don't know, they were above every, head and shoulder above everybody I'd ever known. These guys were tested. They proved themselves. A lot of them were wounded, died, and everything. But I think I enjoyed the memories because I enjoyed, it was like watching a movie. I would think of something, maybe a trigger would happen, and I'd think of a combat episode, but I would just go into this stage of just, I wanted to see the whole movie. I wanted to see everything that happened. And I think it was, the thing that bothered me worse was the absence of those guys in my life. It was a feeling of abandonment, maybe. And it made me feel like I was by myself. I'd enjoy those movies, but nobody else could see them with me, if that was any made sense.
Well, and I'll say that the friendships that you made in I was not in the infantry and that type of thing like you were, but in the threatening circumstances that were Vietnam are probably the most intense friendships that you'll ever make in this life. They're in many ways probably more heartfelt and meaningful than even your love for your wife. There's some kind of a bond there. I guess this is why they have veterans organizations and everything, is so that you can try to maintain that, because it's so intense and so important. So I understand exactly what you're saying, Ray.
I think that part of belonging and, you know, that intense relationship and belonging after the war, whether it's the veterans organizations or a handful of getting everybody together, I mean, that's obviously one coping mechanism that you can get the thing. But then the other thing that keep bringing up, and the thing that we keep hearing and hearing and hearing, and I heard it again over Veterans Day, and we've mentioned before, is so many Vietnam veterans are so bitter. Because the Vietnam veteran says, well, we were there and we did our job. We didn't lose the war, but the politicians and the protesters lost the war. And then I come back and going, what was there to win?
Well, yeah, I'll agree with that. But what made me angry, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but what made me upset was you got off the plane and got on a bus, and all the windows were wire mesh. You know, he said, gee, that's strange. They must have some darn big mosquitoes here. And the guy said, well, that's so as we're going through the civilian areas, somebody doesn't toss a grenade in. And he went, wait a minute. I'm on the other side of the world. I thought we were helping these people. And you immediately run into what they used to call the MGR or the Mir Gook rule. They don't count for anything. You know, it's not about them. We're here. General Westmoreland at one point said that the wonderful part of the Vietnam War was that it gave us this opportunity to test our latest weapons and tactics. It's the only area where you can say the war was a success. What we saw was we'd been lied to. we were not there for the good of the people, and it's exactly what's happening with the guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, that they get there, and you see the cruelty, and you see the indiscriminate damage that's done by the bombing and the artillery and drones, faceless people being massacred. And you say, wait a minute, you lied to me. You know, I can't take pride in this. This is a bloodbath. Everything I ever learned about thou shalt not kill and all of that, this flies right in the face of it. It's immoral. And there aren't too many people you can say that to in the military on the other side of the world, but it eats away at you inside. There's a statement that a vast majority of people suffering from PTSD are guys who feel they committed war crimes. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. Or, you know, at least you were wearing the uniform, you were part of something really horrible. And I call that, I've got another book up in New York looking for a publisher, but I call that the American way of waging war. I think it changed drastically after World War II. World War II, we, you know, finally liberated France, and all the pretty girls stood on the sidewalks and cheered the soldiers, and what a wonderful thing. But in Vietnam, there wasn't any of that. They despised us. They were trying to throw off foreign oppression. They were trying to become independent, and we were the bad guys. And boy, it made for a lot of tension. And when you stopped and looked at it and thought about it, or when you've read a few hundred books over the last 50 years, you can't escape that. That, geez, we were the guys in the black hats, you know, and there's a lot of guilt to that.
Yeah, one of the things that I work quite a bit on, and Doug and I have discussed this multiple times, but there is a post-traumatic stress is based on fear, or trauma is based on fear. And that comes in combat of many ways. But what you're talking about, what I identify with, John, is called moral injury, where you Yes. violate your conscience or even a deeply held or knowledge of a biblical view or something like that, where you feel like you've been violated or you violated certain things, and it's called moral injury, and that's one part of what people suffer in combat or in a war zone.
Well, so I'm glad to hear you bring up the subject, Ray. I am a firm believer in that. I think that's 90% of what I've felt all these years. Boy, if you you bring up that subject at the VA or, you know, some of the meetings that are government-funded and run and orchestrated, they look at you like you're out of your mind and will take you aside and say, don't bring that up here. We don't want to talk about that here. The government says it doesn't exist, and that's the way it is. Well, you know, if you got cancer and the doctor says, oh, we don't want to talk about that, it doesn't exist, you're not going to get better you know, very soon. And it's a sad, sad thing. I'm overwhelmingly glad to hear you bring up the subject, because that's the message. That's what, you know, I don't think it's just coincidence that the Army went with their marketing, merchandising, advertising programs, went from be all you can be, gee, doesn't that sound promising, to an army of one. When you feel PTSD, there's nobody to talk to. You are literally an army of one on your own, all alone. And don't look for help, because there isn't any.
Well, that abandonment is the reason that we've lost, you know, one of our co-hosts in this radio show, Paul, and another reason why Terry tried to commit suicide about 4 weeks ago today. I mean, it's that abandonment that you're left alone and everybody's looking at you saying, well, it doesn't exist. The problems don't exist. When you look at the stuff on depleted uranium, and I was just literally, because I'm trying to get my care again Monday, just a couple days ago, and you read the official stuff, and it said, nobody's sick, and there's no medical problems, and we're only 70 people. Well, I had 123 that survived friendly fire, and over 300 that worked directly for me, cleaned it up just on the processing during Desert Storm, and thousands more. And they say, well, we've only treated 70 people. Well, if you don't look at them, you won't find the problems. And if you don't look for the problems when they're in front of you, because, again, the denial is insistent there to sustain the use, you got a moral injury beyond comprehension.
Yeah, true. The thing in my book, John, I dug real deep inside of me because I wanted to take people into the combat and feel the emotions and the fears of combat itself to an 18, 19-year-old kid away from, you know, home and 10,000 miles. And in that combat, I dealt with something. Back then, you didn't call it moral injury. You didn't know what it was, really. But there were a lot of things in my book that came out as moral injury. And in the last 2 years, the VA has opened up to it a little bit, and I've been able to teach classes. Tomorrow I'll be at Camp Lejeune speaking on the very subject to Marines and sailors coming back from Afghanistan, Iraq, different places, on the subject of moral injury. We're trying to get them help, and I teach an entire 90-minute class on it. And so it has started opening up, and fortunately it has, because they say that more suicides come out of moral injury than it does post-trauma because of the guilt factor.
Yeah, I would buy that.
Right. So, you know, God is the one that really, the reason that we feel violated is because of certain beliefs we have, moral truths about society and things, how we should treat each other. And when you go into war zones, especially at a young age before you ever matured, you are doing things you never comprehended you would. And so you come back and it takes, well, you got that way because of God's laws, and only through God can you get really ultimate healing. Although there are certain things you can do to get a sense of forgiveness of people who hurt you, forgiveness from what you've done to them, and then ultimately forgiving your own self. And so it's got a lot to do with forgiveness. And people are moving on.
Well, I know. There's an awful lot of people also that are not. There are people really, really hurting and not finding the help that they need in the conventional places, you know. That's the sadness. I lived in a small town in western New Jersey for a long time, and my wife knew a lady. Her son-in-law had been in Iraq, actually did three tours there, but there were 9 guys that went over together, and they all came home. And within a year and a half, 5 of the 9 had committed suicide. And nobody would put it in the paper. Nobody would talk about it. It was this, 300-pound gorilla in the room or whatever you want to call it, that around town people were aware. But there was no way to deal with it. He had a knee that was in desperate, terrible shape, that was great pain and everything, and he went to the VA about his knee, and they said, we can't do a knee replacement on somebody your age. Here, have some pain pills. Take lots of pain pills. You'll feel so much better. And he finally did get his head together pretty well. To my knowledge, he's still alive today. And he, had a couple of kids and got a job trying to work with vets and help them with actual vocational skills. And he felt like he had some worth in life. But when he went to somebody and said, I'm hurting, will you help me? The answer was no, and damaged him all the more. You know, that's the cruelty of this thing.
I agree with you 100%. Some of the classes that I do teach moral injury to, John, are groups of military veteran or military personnel. They're active duty, most of them, that have never been overseas, though. And they're having the same post-trauma effects and moral injury, but it came through their life before military and then sometimes during military, sexual trauma, physical trauma, verbal trauma, and they're showing the same classic signs of post-traumatic stress as the ones coming back from Afghanistan.
Yeah, I would not find that surprising at all. If I may, just to divert the subject matter a little bit, you talked about suicide a little bit ago. I was surprised to find, you know, you see it on television all the time. Oh, boy, isn't this wonderful? The VA says that the rate of suicides has dropped, in quotes, from 22 a day down to only 20. This is real progress. What I discovered was, when I started looking into it, is that it is extremely rare to find a community medical facility that looks at a suicide or a suicide attempt and researches the guy's background or the person's background, says, oh, yes, they were a veteran, they were this, they were that, reports back in any way to the VA or anything. So those statistics where they receive them are from such a small sampling of society that the truth of the matter is probably, 10, 100, 50 times as much. Nobody really knows how many veterans are committing suicide. And to play with those numbers and put them on television and try to manipulate our thoughts, I resent that. I think that's back to the old marketing and merchandising again.
That goes at marketing and merchandising, the same thing, and we've talked about this before, John, and you and I talked about in prep, is what makes a hero. I mean, today it's almost as if you put on a military uniform, you're almost labeled as a hero, and there's nothing heroic about what's going on.
Well,
where does that leave a guy? I mean, where does that leave a guy thinking? Because in his mind he knows, hey, I just did my job. In most cases it didn't work out real well. And now they think I'm a hero for doing what?
Yeah, the expectation versus the reality of what you do every day, which is in the military, pretty humdrum existence until you're actually, you know, in a combat situation. Most of it is conducted at about a fifth to sixth grade reading level, and there are a lot of aspects of it that are less than exciting. And so you endure through that, and then you go home, and, you know, the pretty girl comes up and says, oh, look at your uniform. Wow, you must really be a macho man. And you know, in the back of your head, geez, I don't fit that description. I don't really measure up. And there's a guild aspect to that too.
Well, it is, and it's called unrecognized. I mean, undeserved recognition. And it's the problem with suicide is that a lot of people come back and they're in the military, but everybody was recognized as a big hero and everything, and they pump it up. And we see that on the news sometimes where they've chosen somebody to give them a Medal of Honor. And the guy, I mean, most people that do get a medal don't feel like they do deserve it. It's people around him that have recognized certain things. But they have sometimes given it to people that, it wasn't that big a deal, that maybe they did something spontaneous. But they feel like really dirt, and they go through life, and it has a very negative, depressing reaction to that. So I think they've overdone it many times of trying to recognize too many people of just doing their daily job, and it has a negative effect.
Well, I'd like to say a couple of things about that. In my book, I made mention the invasion of Grenada. There were fewer than 5,000 American troops took part in that. There were more killed and more wounded by friendly fire than by enemy fire. And those 5,000 people, they awarded more than 9,000 medals, number one. Number two, you ever look at some of these, you know, real professional generals, the joint chiefs of staff and like that? Those guys have got all those ribbons all over their chest. Am I naive or something? There haven't been that many wars and conflicts in our time that they could have won all of those. They don't signify this is the Vietnam War, this is the Iraq War, this is Afghanistan. They get medals, I don't know, for brushing their teeth in the morning or something. I can't imagine what they do to earn all of that stuff. But I know they don't give it out to privates.
That's true. Yeah, they have to look good, fill the uniform up sometimes. But, you know, to real heroes, they're the last one to even think about it. And I think that's always been the case. I had a friend, it's in my book, actually, his name was Bob DeRuze, and Bob did one of the bravest things I'd ever seen. He crawled through an enemy ambush, got a downed Marine, drugged the guy back, and he just turned 18 years old. But nobody saw him do it but me. I mean, I was the squad leader. And he was going to go totally unrecognized. And I finally put him in for a Bronze Star, and he got a Bronze Star. To me, he could have got a Medal of Honor for what he did. And so I found out many years later, he came back home and put himself in a mental health program because his nerves were so shot. And I think that's the average hero we see many times. They go unrecognized.
Yeah. The other part,
sadly.
The other part of that, when the person, whatever they got the medal or everything, and this is the assumption that's made, well, okay, I got wounded, or I got ill, or I got injured, or whatever happened. So now I'm going to go to the VA, or I'm in the military, I'm going to go to the hospital, and they're going to recognize me and say, we're going to do everything we can for you. We're going to give you good medical care. We're going to help you get on your feet. And then you find out, as Paul Lyons and Terry and all these other guys have found out, and Jeff Lucy, they don't give you the care. I mean, they claim you're a hero and you did all this stuff, but when you go out to get it, they don't give you the prompt and optimal medical care that you need, or they disavow any connection with it. I mean, Agent Orange and depleted uranium and all this stuff is a perfect example. Yeah, we know we got zapped. We were healthy. We went over there. We got zapped, and all of a sudden we're not healthy, and then we expect the care, and they say you're a hero. But there's no support there. And the number of homeless vets are out there, I mean, you know, Ray, you're working with these vets that are in prison. I mean, there's nothing there, is there?
It doesn't seem to be. I mean, they've been stripped of everything. And I do say that, I mean, a lot of them got into trouble. They did things. I mean, maybe they were drinking when they did it, or maybe they were on drugs when they did it. But a lot of them in prison, veterans, have post-traumatic stress. Or a lot of them, and through the self-medicating part, because they don't tell anybody, or they don't go to the VA, or they can't get medical treatment, they go into trying to self-medicate themselves, or if they are in the VA and they get pain meds like yourself, Doug, that a lot of times you'll go a week or two without pain meds because the VA doesn't get it to you, and these guys will go out and find it, and when they find it, it's usually in seedy places, in bad places, and they're around the wrong people, and they get into trouble, or they get caught buying drugs, and they end up in prison. And in prison, they have started certain post-traumatic stress programs, and I've been invited to come back in there to a maximum security prison where they have young military personnel that are suffering. So I do, you know, I understand people got into trouble. They've done bad things. But there are some that got caught up into that system, and they were trying to find their way through it when they got into trouble. So I think there's a reason to go back in there and try to find the ones who want help and who are willing to maybe, if they got a couple of years to pull in prison, that's a great time to get your life started out. You can go back to school. You can get online, and they'll let you do that. And so they can become really good citizens from being in prison for a couple of years to help get their life back on track.
And don't you think that guys like yourself are, you talk about heroes, but are so important to this whole thing, that these guys are alone in a, you know, basically in a cage away from their family and everything that they know is normal. And here comes somebody that instead of, you know, showing them how tough they can be, actually takes time to listen and understand and try to help. To me, that type of thing is really a hero. My hat's off to you.
Well, I feel the same way about you, too. I mean, we're trying to reach out to veterans even through Warrior Connection because maybe there are millions of people that will hear us. And all we can do is encourage them to try to get their heads together, stop where you are, realize where you've been, where you are, and where do you want to go from here, and you start over. And wherever you are in life, and that's what we're trying to encourage, John, through your book and our books and everything that Doug has done. And we're reaching veterans. We're finding it is working, that they can actually begin to start over, make some positive things, try not to go back and make the same mistakes or fewer regrets and things like this. And they can actually begin to move forward into a positive and become a vibrant citizen of the United States. Even though you got a bad past.
You got problems every day. And, John, in your book, you got pictures there of a convoy 23 days after you got in the thing where your convoy got nailed. Did those pictures, I mean, for all of us, and when I have a picture or a flashback, it brings back a flashback of the memories and or a sound or a smell or a date. How do you relate when you go back in your book and you look at these pictures of the horror you experienced in the past? How does a vet, I mean, how can we deal with that? How can a vet deal with that?
You know, I had a pretty successful career in automotive. I worked for some very big manufacturers, had positions of considerable responsibility and lots of employees under me and that kind of thing. And that's difficult. Corporate life is very, very difficult. And I would go back and look at some of the pictures I brought home and some of the memories and that and say, man, with what you've been through, this is nothing. It actually helped to a certain extent for me to maintain my confidence in myself and deal with the corporate life, I'll call it. I think if anybody's in it, they know exactly what I'm talking about. But you just say, hey, you know, I've been through worse than this. I can make this. And it does give you a certain amount of confidence in yourself.
It's true, and one of the things I try to explain in some of the programs that I'm doing is that the rearview mirror can be a positive, but can also be a big negative, because it said that if you forget your past, you're destined to repeat it, but if you dwell on your past, it will rob your future. And what I try to convince them is, regardless how bad your past is, you cannot allow your past to control your future. I go back to pictures once in a while, pictures I'm not proud of sometimes, but I do have some of those stuffed away somewhere. The problem is you can't stay there very long. You can't focus on that rearview mirror because you cannot drive a car forward looking in a rearview mirror. You
Yep.
can't run forward looking backwards. And so you have to use it like a rearview mirror where you glance at it and you see the mistakes you made, and you try not to make them again, but you do it like driving a car. You've got to keep your eyes on the horizon. You've got to move on and only visit your past in very short and small spurts.
And I think that comes into this thing, but we've talked about for over and over again here is forgiveness. I mean,
right.
You have to forgive yourself for what things that we're involved in because we couldn't control them or deal with them at that time. But once you get that forgiveness concept, and then, and for me, and I mean all of us, it's extraordinarily difficult to forgive those guys that stomped on us, but we have to at some point. But at the same time, we've got to make sure that the medical care and the mistakes that we made before don't happen again.
True.
Yeah, I agree.
See, one of the things that didn't bother me recently, again, it was in the news. I mean, the U.S. military is using the DU munitions in Syria. I mean, didn't they learn their lesson?
No. Apparently not.
No, I don't think anybody has learned any lessons in the Pentagon. Those are pretty impenetrable walls. You know, when you read about there's a book out right now called The Burn Pits that talks about the toxic smoke from burning all the trash, including human bodies, for God's sake, and the smoke blowing right into the camps in Iraq and Afghanistan against all the rules and everything, and nobody will do anything about it. The VA will not acknowledge that this could be the problem. This book, the author is of the opinion that Vice President Biden's son died of poisoning from this type of smoke. It's Agent Orange all over again, and depleted uranium all over again. And you know what? They don't care. There's an article today in the news about dumping toxic chemicals and DU in the oceans, the Navy, huge amounts of this stuff, and they don't care. It's, you know, we've got our mission to do. We're on this higher plateau. We don't care what happens to common people. We've got to accomplish our mission. And that's not the America I heard about in high school. You know, I find it very, very difficult to accept that type of activity.
Yeah, I read that story after you gave it to me this morning.
The end justifies the means. And then the old adage of acceptable losses, because they have to justify things. And for a better end, we have to consider acceptable losses, whether it be in people or the environment or whatever it is, to meet our end or meet our goals. And it's always got a negative thing for people. You know, they used to say, I think during the 60s, war is no good to children and every other living thing.
Yep.
Because people get hurt, you know?
And that's, you know, you talk about a message to young people considering going into the military and everything. There's a lot of financial pressure today on young people. There aren't a lot of jobs out there. You know, I understand why they would consider that. But you try to tell them that you don't count for anything. You are entirely expendable. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, nobody's going to, you know, your mom will shed tears over you, but nobody in the military is going to give a damn, and you're just gone. You're collateral damage, whatever they want to call it. They have little terms and buzzwords that they use to tell you you're worthless. And that's what you've got to tell kids. There's a great book. A lady by the name of Ann Jones did a book called They Were Soldiers. She followed guys, wounded guys in Afghanistan from the moment they were hurt, followed them all the way back on the plane to Germany and the hospital there, back to the States, to their hospitals, talked with their families and everything. Boy, that book should be mandatory reading for any young person that's going to enlist in the military. They should be made to read that before they raise their hand.
You know, an example that you can see on the news where some football player or something will die, and they'll have 3 days of broadcast on it. But in the meantime, you lose 10 or 15 military personnel over in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they're never mentioned.
Yeah, and then you keep hearing about Pat Tillman. Pat Tillman was killed by friendly fire. Who was responsible for that? I haven't heard of anybody being held responsible.
Well, Pat Tillman had figured out all the lies and everything. He was starting to speak out. And because of his notoriety as a football player, gave up a career to came back, people would have listened to him, and so they had to get rid of him. I mean, you know, this is the hard reality of it.
There's a lot of people of that opinion that he was quieted, and that, think about that. Boy, you want to, be all you can be an army of one. Holy moly.
Well, they say 1% is our military numbers in, or statistics in America. 1% of Americans go into military. And if you go down to Disney World down in Florida, it's a place of fun and games and laughter and food and everything. But they got a very small security team out there, and they're watching over all these people, trying to give them a good day. And they could care less about that security team. They have that's not even in their minds. And they if they see somebody, they barely even say thank you, if they even do that. And I think the same thing is in America. They're so carried off with having their lives and loving it and enjoying it and doing their things that they forget all about the military, the sacrifices those men and women do to give us the freedoms. You know, they always say land of the free because of the brave. They forget about the brave.
But we got to look at the other part of this, and this is the heart comes into. For all the wars and the battles, I mean, no doubt about World War One, no doubt about World War Two, but Vietnam posed no threat to our way of life, to our government, to our freedoms, or anything. Desert Storm posed no threat, or Grenada posed no threat. Going into Central America, Nicaragua and all that posed no threat. In Iraq and Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya posed absolutely no threat. They don't have a military that can even get here, much less do anything to suspend our freedoms or gun or rights and everything we live in. So now you're caught in the catch-22. Well, if this isn't really about fighting for freedom, what is it? And then you come to the realization it's about economic domination and political control. And then we're used as a pawn. I mean, that's the hardcore reality that, my God, for me to face that, for any of us to face that, we're warriors. That's so incredibly difficult. That's that deep moral injury that's happening, the realization, I'm not fighting for freedoms.
But you know, Doug, when I went to Vietnam, I really didn't think about a lot of things. I guess I went by the old adage of it is not mine to question why. Mine is but to do or die kind of stupidity. But I think with young men and women, that could be the reason they go, because if they analyze things, if they really read it, they probably won't go.
Right.
And so they want to keep you in the dark.
Well, and then there's the undercurrents, too. And I tried to bring some of that out in my book. I thought I was seeing an aberration, a one-of-a-kind set of circumstances, and discovered that, boy, it was the rule, not the exception. But when I arrived in Thailand, I got off the plane and went over to sign in, and the company commander called me in his office and said, hey, we have this problem with the 105 self-propelled howitzers that when they fire them a few times, the body is made of cast aluminum, and the gun recoil breaks this seam at the bottom, in the well where the gun recoils into, and it fills up with diesel fuel and starts on fire. It's really a great target for the bad guys. I understand you know how to fix them. And I said, yeah, I do. I have done that. And he said, well, we really need somebody to take care of those guns. Now, I'm in Thailand, and there isn't supposed to be a war in Thailand, but he says, here's the deal. If you will accept the responsibility to do that and to fix these guns for us, we can make you a Sergeant E5. You'll be the platoon sergeant, and you know, you get a raise and you can live pretty well in Thailand and enjoy yourself. And I said, well, you know, okay, I can do that. I know how to do that. And he says, okay, do me a favor. Take off your clothes. Excuse me? He said, no, I have to look and see if you have any tattoos or birthmarks or anything. And then he begins to tell me, when you go out on these missions, you cannot have any kind of identification, no dog tags, no picture of your girlfriend, no nothing. You have a set of fatigue, U.S. Army, no anything on it. I had a truck, a three-quarter ton with welding equipment in the back. Every number, everything was ground off. It was painted olive drab, no white stars, no serial numbers, no nothing. When the occasion came, I drove it up to a helicopter that was exactly the same, and all the guys on the helicopter crew, you know, they had no names on their uniform or anything like that. And we went up and, you know, flew for a while and landed, and, you know, it looked like, if you remember the old movie All Quiet on the Western Front, where you got fog and steam and a broken-up old tree stump out there and craters every place. Well, that's what it was. And the guy says to me, you know, we don't have, the president says we don't have anybody in Laos. So I tell you something, man, you ain't nowhere. Anything happens to you, you don't exist. And you listen to that kind of thing and think about how you're being manipulated. It's really, really hard to understand. And you know, the graft and corruption in the military is so bad. What it turned out was, in Thailand, the reason they had an opening for a platoon sergeant was the old one was coming on the base on his motorcycle and somebody stretched a piano wire and cut his head off. He knew about a deal that was going on where brand new trucks would come in off the transporter and they would say they were damaged beyond repair and salvageable and sell them downtown for big profits.
Well, the other problem you run into, and this is the same thing, is, again, missions we did and what we were involved in. Today they claim we weren't there and we didn't do it, whether it was teaching nuclear and biological chemical warfare or cleaning up Project Shad, or responding to another chemical incident where they were doing research with chemical and biological munitions at a university or a hospital or whatever it is. And then, well, you guys weren't there and you didn't do it, because that way they can avoid responsibility for claiming that the event happened. Sort of like here at Chinook Air Force Base, they're claiming we didn't do a nuclear biological chemical warfare training before we deployed for Desert Storm. Let me tell you, we did. That's the only reason we're alive.
Well, you know, there was a lot of things that went on sometimes. My company, I wrote a story in the book about when we went inside the DMZ in that 4 miles deep area that ran the width of the country, supposed to be a demilitarized zone, nobody in there. Well, the enemy was in there, and they used it because we couldn't bomb it. But our company was assigned, our battalion was in the area, our company was assigned to go inside the DMZ and capture a prisoner, and Ollie North is the one who got him. But you couldn't cross that Ben Hur River with a company, only 4 men at a time, which were recon teams, could go inside the DMZ. And so my company split up in 4 men teams and went across that river. And then on the other side, we formed back up, and that's where we went. So they do things to accomplish the goal or the mission, but a lot of times they do it to a way that nobody could recognize what's happened here. So it's pretty amazing what they do to cover up some things. And
we only got a few minutes
good,
left.
I guess, and sometimes it's not.
John, tell us how to get a copy of your book. I know I've seen it on the bookshelf still to this day, but give us some more information on your book here for the last couple few minutes.
Well, the book is called And a Hard Rain Fell. I paid Bob Dylan a few dollars for that. It was taken from, the old Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. It's in most bookstores and certainly available to be ordered and everything. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and readily available. And I'm very proud of the fact that it was originally published in 1985 and has stayed out there. I think at this point it's around 27 printings and has been very successful. It's done very well, just staying alive that long. And I'm proud of it. It's the truth, and it's the way it really was, and I think it's very human. And, I think it's good. I think it's what people need to know.
And so again, John Ketwig, KETWIG, again, is our author and our guest today. I mean, where's the future? I mean, we've had the VA writing program people on here and writing stories and writing books, guys. You two have written two of the key books on Vietnam and PTSD and recovery. What's the future hold? I mean, all the vets can write, can't they?
Yeah,
they can
actually,
all write, and they've all got to...
There's programs encouraging them to write, to get it out and put it on paper and help get that poison out of your system.
Well, hey, John, thank you very much. Ray, thank you very much. God bless everybody, and let's keep moving. Life goes on. The windows have opened. A new door is open. Go on. Get an education. Thrive in life. It can happen. Thank you very much, and God bless you guys.
Hey, thank you, Doug and Ray. Appreciate it.